God is still making nations now. And now what happens is everybody who comes to God through Jesus Christ, we are placed within His nation. And you look around and you understand this morning as we sit here and worship, we are worshiping as a holy nation. We are His people and He is our God.
Are you looking for meaning or a word from God that's relevant to your life? Are you searching for a better understanding of who God is? Well, you're in the right place. You found the Gary Talks About God podcast. This is a weekly podcast that comes to you from the pulpit of Red Bank Missionary Baptist Church in Germantown, North Carolina. The podcast is hosted by Red Bank Senior Pastor Gary Sanders. Now let's get ready to take that walk through God's Word with our pastor, teacher, and friend. Hey, he's that guy we call Gary.
Go ahead and take your Bibles and open to Genesis 25. This morning we're making a major transition in our study of Genesis. Actually, in two ways. Way number one is after this one, we're halfway through. So 50 chapters, 25, we will be done. We're over halfway. But also, for the past 14 chapters, and I went back and then looked it up, the past 6 months, we have been studying the life of Abraham. From the time he is called out of Ur of the Chaldeans to journey to a land that God will show him, to him entering the land, to him God entering into the covenant with him and ratifying the covenant, the promised land, the seed, the blessing, to him going down to Egypt, to the whole story with Hagar and Ishmael, to him interceding for Sodom and Gomorrah, to, you know, his obedience and the bonding of Isaac. You know, we talked about his life and how it was really kind of like a seesaw. At one moment it was way up here, and then the next moment it was way down here. And this morning, the reason it's a major transition is because we read about the death of Abraham. And in Genesis 25, we have his death and two other stories. One kind of what has happened to Ishmael. And then we have the story of the birth of Jacob and Esau. And so, in a way, it looks like it's a disjointed chapter with just three random stories. However, if you understand it as a transitional story from the life of Abraham into the beginning of Isaac and his story and the foreshadowing of Jacob that's going to come later, I think it helps us to understand more what is going on. And one of the key elements that we're going to see as we read this through the transitional lens is the transition as it reminds us that God is working to build a nation. He is working through Abraham and his descendants to build a nation, which is going to lead us to our ending application as well, that God is still in the process of building nations. So Genesis chapter 25, begin in verse 1 all the way down to verse 34. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuan. Jokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. The sons of Dedan were Ashram, Leshumim, and Luminim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanak, Abadiah, and Elada. All these were the children of Keturah. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac. But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts, and while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac, eastward to the east country. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zoar the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. After the death of Sarah, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Laharoi. These are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, named in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, and Abdil, Mibsam, Misham, Duma, Masa, Hadad, Tema, Jetur, Napshis, and Kedemah. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their encampments. 12 princes according to their tribes. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. He breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is opposite Egypt in the direction of Assyria. He settled over against all his kinsmen. These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together with her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and the two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. After this, his brother came out in his hands holding to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skilled hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field. He was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. You can see there, as you read through that chapter, you can see those three very distinct stories, and they seem kind of vaguely related, but really kind of disjointed a little bit. But keep in mind, as we go through this, this is a transitional statement, or a transitional chapter. A lot is going on. And the first thing that happens in this chapter we see is the death of a patriarch. The death of a patriarch. Abraham's life is about to end. And as it starts in chapter 25, we already know that his princess Sarah is dead. We know that he has buried her in the cave of Machpelah and that little plot of land that he now owns. And while we're not told the math exactly, we can imagine that he lived about another 30 years after Sarah. And so it's not surprising on the one hand, but at the same time, it does catch us a little off guard when we're told that he has taken another wife. After all, he loved Sarah, and he called her, she was his princess and that love, and we would think, well, he would just live out the rest of his days, but he ends up marrying someone else and fathering, as we see, six more children. And this is the first time that Abraham has more than one child by the same woman. He has Ishmael through Hagar, he has Isaac through Sarah, but now he has six through Keturah. And so we see his life continuing on until we read in verse 7 that he breathed his last and he died at the age of 175 years old. All right, that's a long time. He lived a long life, and it makes sure that we know this. This is, and if you're keeping up with the genealogy and his age and everything, this is about 100 years after he left Haran, traveling to the land that God would show him. And so after 100 years of following God, it says that he breathed his last and he died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and would gather to his people. Now just reading that, we would think that it was just a summary of what happened, just an obituary of Abraham. But when you read that really carefully, you notice a couple things. And the first one is, it says that he died a full age. He died full of life. What does that mean? And it's a good question to ask. And I think many people will look at this and go, you know what? What made his life full is he lived to be 175 years old. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never met anybody that's lived 175 years old. Okay? Just doesn't happen. I think we have all met people who have lived into their 90s. We've met several that have lived into their hundreds. And I think we can look back and not trying to be rude or disrespectful, that we can say as they get and approach that life, is their life full just because they lived that long? Is the number of years the defining characteristic of a full life? Because if it is, that's a horrible metric. Because it forces you then to answer the question about the people who do not live to be 90, 100 years old. Did they not live a full life if they died in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s? Is a full life measured by stuff that you don't take with you? I know that trends right now in funerals, and I have a pastor buddy of mine whose family is in the funeral business, and every now and then he posts these articles of what people are doing at funerals and how you can have your funeral and all this stuff, and he just kind of shakes his head, and I kind of shake my head as well. But one of the things that's amazing about all those funerals and everything that's happening in funerals is people still aren't taking it with them. You know? You can dig a huge grave and bury it beside you, but you ain't taking it with you. Is a full life measured by the amount of stuff that we have? How do we measure a full life? Why was Abraham living a full life? He lived a long life, yes. God prospered him, yes. But is that the metrics? Because if those are the metrics, we have to explain to a lot of people who don't have a lot of stuff, who don't have a lot of health, who don't live a whole long life, why they can still have a full life. But if the metric is not that, if the metric is he died in a full, living a full life because for 100 years he walked with God and the fullness of God was in him, then it doesn't matter how old you are, how much stuff you have. If you have God in you, living in you and residing with you and you're following him, then you have a full life. And that's the metric that we need to understand. And that's the metric we need to gauge life by. So when you get to whenever you are in your life, it doesn't matter if you're 20s, 30s, 40s, it doesn't matter where you are. And you say, am I living a full life? And if you can say, Christ resides in me and I'm following him and I'm doing his will, then it doesn't matter what else looks around you. The answer is yes. Because a full life is measured if we are following and living in fellowship with God. So Abraham, by that metric, lived a full life, full of years. But then if you look closely at the pattern of death, it's very interesting, the order that is given. Breathed his last, died, gathered to his people, and then he's buried. Do you see the problem? He breathed his last, died, gathered to his people, and then he is buried. It is interesting that gathered to his people is placed after death but before burial. This is before he's placed in the tomb with Sarah. And it's got to mean something different. Each one of those terms have to mean something different, or Juan bring it up. Dying and being gathered to your people and being buried are three very distinct terms. What in the world is the author here talking about? Well, very simply, and while it's not a full-fledged representation of life after death, the author is letting us know that there's an implied belief that when a person dies on this earth, there is still an existence that stretches beyond death. And when Abraham is gathered to his people, he is joining the realm of those who have already been redeemed. He is joining them because he knows that there is life in existence after this one. And we see this picked up throughout the New Testament. Jesus talks about this, and he tells a story in Luke chapter 16. Remember the story of Lazarus and the rich man? Not Lazarus, Mary and Martha's sister, but another Lazarus. And it says that when Lazarus died and the rich man died, that wasn't the end of their lives. It says Lazarus was carried to Abraham's side or Abraham's bosom while the rich man was carried to Hades. And so there is this understanding then that after we die on this earth, that it's just a portal to the life that is to come. And the question is, where are we going to be carried after this life? Because we're going to be carried somewhere. And I don't mean to the cemetery. Are we going to be carried to Abraham's side? And the idea in that story that Jesus is telling is that Lazarus is there with Abraham in the presence of God, enjoying everything that a redeemed would, while the rich man is carried to Hades and he's miserable, he's uncomfortable. He doesn't want to be there. He wants to go and be with Lazarus, and if he can't, he wants to warn his brothers and say, "You don't want to be where I am. Can I just step back on earth for a little bit and tell them?" And Jesus says, "No, for the decision of where we're carried after this life is made in this life, not the life to come. Because if it was, no one would choose to be carried to Hades. Nobody would choose to be separated from God." And so we see then in his death that we need to understand the metrics by which we gauge our life as whether it's full or empty, and understand that in our death, then, there is more to it. There is life beyond. Where are we going to go? Are we going to be carried and be in God's presence and Christ's presence and walk with Abraham, or are we going to be carried away from him and out of God's presence? And so then, after that process, it does say that they buried him. I find verse 9 to be really an intriguing statement, because it says that Isaac and Ishmael buried him. Ishmael has been sent off, but he comes back to bury his father. And they take him and they bury him in the cave of Machpelah. They bury him in that one little thing that he owns that cave, that tomb, and they bury him there beside Sarah in that tomb and that promised down payment that they one day would possess the land. And so as they put him in there and they seal the tomb, we kind of ask ourselves, are the promises dead? Abraham is dead. Are the promises dead, or did they die with him? And the answer is no. Because as it transitions to the story about Isaac, what we see is the unfolding promises of the covenant. In verses 12 through 18, promises continue to unfold. And it's going to unfold through Abraham's heirs. And if you're keeping track, he now has eight. He now has eight sons. And so if you had eight sons in modern times, what would you do? Each kid would get what? An eighth. It's pretty simple. My kids would get a sixth. Right? You don't want to offend anybody. They're not going to be offended. You know? So you give each one six equal parts. Abraham give each one eight equal parts. So everybody would share equally in the estate. But this is not what would happen then. This is what doesn't happen in still many of the Middle East cultures. What would happen is the oldest son would get probably half, or the lion's share, we might say, of the estate. And then the rest would be divided. Well, that's an interesting proposition, because if the first got it, who would get it? Ishmael. He is the firstborn. He doesn't get it either. Who gets it? It says that Abraham gives all that he has to Isaac, gives everything to Isaac. Now, we also understand that that's a little bit of hyperbole, because then we read that he gives gifts to his other kids. But what we need to say and what we need to understand from this is that Abraham is not following the norm and giving everything to Isaac, because God has told Abraham that Isaac is the chosen heir. Isaac is the one that's going to carry on the covenantal promises. And so for that reason, Isaac gets, quote unquote, everything, as we read in verse 5. And so he's going to carry on. Why would Abraham do that? You know you're going to cause grief. Well, because we just said that he's been walking with God and in fellowship with God. And so this is a wise man who is doing exactly what God has instructed. And we see that he's doing that where in verse 11, it says that God blessed his son Isaac. It does not say that about any of the other children that Abraham have. God reaches down and blesses Isaac. He is going to be the one. He's going to be the one where the promises of the covenant continue to start unfolding. And so to provide an extra layer of protection, Abraham again does something that I don't quite understand. I understand the logic behind, but I'd like to know the emotion behind it. He says that he sends his sons from Keturah away, eastward to the east country. Well, that makes sense. If you're going eastward, you're going to the east country. He sends them away. But there's no emotion in this text. We saw the emotion when he sent Ishmael away. He didn't want to do that, but he did. We saw the emotion in the binding of Isaac. That was difficult. But here, there's no type of emotion revealed. It's just he sent them away. We don't know about the sons, how they felt. We saw how Ishmael felt. We have a good idea how Isaac felt. But we don't see anything about them. Did they feel like they were being rejected? Or like, hey, we're going on a grand adventure. Let's go. But he sends them east, away from what? The promised land. He doesn't send them westward into the land. He sends them eastward, away from the land that has been promised to Abraham and his descendants, but his descendants specifically now through Isaac, whom God has blessed. And so for this extra layer of protection and to risk any type of strife, which doesn't actually happen, there's going to be all kinds of strife, he sends all of those kids away. And so that Isaac can stay and remain in the land. But the covenant also unfolds, interestingly enough, through those kids who have been sent away. It unfolds through what we see here in Ishmael and his children as they start to settle. Because what you see is the unfolding promise of the covenant that he's going to have descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. And so they start to spread out, and through Abraham, and yes, all of his kids, even though Isaac is the bearer of the promises, they start to spread out and settle in all these different lands. And so you start to see the covenantal promises becoming fulfilled. You see God keep his promise that he made to Abraham. Remember Abraham pleading for Ishmael, oh Lord, that you would make Ishmael great. And God says, I will make him the father of 12 princes. Abraham's going to be the father of kings, but you're going to be the father of 12 princes. And you come through here and you read his genealogy of Ishmael, you see the 12 princes as they are spreading out as well. The covenantal promises did not die with Abraham. They're continuing. And that's a great comfort to us. Right, to understand that our death on this earth or a loved one's death on this earth does not mean that the promises of God die as well. They remain in force. And we see the outworking then of God's promises. They just kind of, and it's not like, it's sort of like reading a book slowly. We see it just gradually unfolding instead of like a big boom, there it is. It slowly starts to unfold. As you read that, though, there's something interesting that I don't know if it caught your attention or not. But as it's mentioning their names and telling them that they're scattering out, if you look in verse 16, it says that they're scattering out and settling by their villages and by their encampments. Villages and encampments. They're supposed to be a nation. Where is this nation? Well, as a reminder, the nation is not going to come through those six or those 12. The nation is going to come through Isaac. And the closing story is the beginning of the promised nation. The closing story is the beginning of the promised nation. Because it immediately then, in verse 19, turns to the generation of Isaac. And we're told that Isaac now is married. He's 40 years old when he marries Rebekah. And at 20 years later, at 60, she has a child. Now, one of the interesting things about Isaac and Rebekah's life is this almost going to mirror Abraham and Sarah's. Just as Sarah was barren, so is Rebekah. She is barren. So Isaac prayed and said, hey, can we have a child? Because here we have a problem. We're still at two people, right? Abraham had to have Sarah, and he's chosen, and now Isaac is married to Rebekah, but we still only have two people. Two people do not a nation make, okay? If you ever want to watch something just really funny, it's just really funny, go Google sovereign citizens who think that they are their own nation, and watch what sovereign citizens try to do in the face of authority. it never ends well. It's really funny, though. But that's what I'm saying. One person is not a nation. They claim to be a nation. I'm a sovereign citizen. I'm on my own nation. And the sheriff and the police department and everybody else, I don't think so, buddy. You know? And while that's humorous, we understand that one person, two people, does not a nation make. Where is this nation? Where is it? And so when Isaac goes and prays that Rebekah would have children, she conceives. And she's starting to feel like, God, I'm not sure what pregnancy feels like, but something seems a little bit off. So she goes and she prays to God and says, you know, God, there's a lot of movement in here. What's going on? And God answers her and says, look, here's what's happening. Look at what he says. He does not say that two people, he does not say that two sons, he does not say that two babies, not two childs, but what? Two nations are in your womb. And we see in that prophecy, that what is happening is, here it comes. The promised nation is close. And the nations that I promised Abraham now is going to come through your womb, Rebekah. And you've got two of them in there, and they're fighting. And just so that you know, they're going to be divided, and one shall be stronger, and the older shall serve the younger. Again, taking everything you know and just flipping it upside down, because it would be the older who would be in a position of authority. But inside of Rebekah are these two nations. And we see then that that nation, that promise, is still there. And that one of those nations then is going to carry on and be the covenant bearer after Isaac as well. And while we don't know which one it is just yet in the prophecy, we know it's going to be the younger. Whoever the younger is, that is the one that's going to carry on the covenant. And so we fast forward 9 months when they're giving birth, and it says the first one came out. Now the first one comes out. Is this the one that's going to bear the covenant? No. But the first one comes out, and how would you like for this to be on your card announcing the birth of your baby? Well, he came out, and he was hairy like a cloak and red. Look at our red, hairy baby. And they called him Esau. And Esau kind of means red, right? I mean, that's what it means. And so then it says that the second one came out, and his name is Jacob. And look at how Jacob is described. Now remember, two nations, the older is going to serve the younger. The old one comes out red and hairy, so he's described by his appearance. The other one that comes out is described by his action. And what kind of child are you going to have? If as his twin brother is being born, you reach out in your womb, grab his ankle as if to pull him back in so that you can go out first. So they called him Jacob, which means heel grabber. That's what it means. And so we don't know a lot about these nations just yet, but we know that the one who is going to carry on the covenantal promise where the nation is going to be made comes out kind of wanting to supplant his brother at birth. And it's going to take a while for Jacob's story to get better. But that's where we are. And so then it fast forwards a little bit more. This is foreshadowing, all right? This is kind of telling us what's going on. And so it fast forwards to when the boys grew up, which tells us nothing, because the terminology there has been used for small kids, lads, teenagers, and young adults. We don't know when the boys grew up. We don't know where this is. And it says Esau becomes a skilled huntsman. He's an outdoorsman, and Jacob is a quiet man dwelling in a tent. Now, later we know that Jacob has flocks and herds, so don't think of quiet as meek homebody. It's really more as a contrast between who the two brothers are. But you can already see this animosity is building up. They're already different. And then we get that verse 28, Isaac loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And you know, man, this is not going to go well. He's already grabbing his heel. The dad loves one. The mom loves another. This is not going to go well. And then we get the last episode that just reinforces what we already know, where it tells us that Jacob is out cooking one day, and Esau comes in, and he's hungry. Now think about this. The skilled hunter is hungry. A few of you got the irony. If he's such a skilled outdoorsman, he shouldn't be hungry. He should have caught something, but he comes in and he says, hey, literally, give me some red. All right, that's what they're asking. They throw in stew so we know what he means. And on just a side note, it may help you in your Bibles to make a note that Edom is derived from red. Seir is derived from red or hairy. And so when you read about Edom and Seir and Esau, those are all the same. Okay, Edom and Seir are the descendants. Esau, you know, the patriarch of that line. So that's who they're referring to later on. But he is so hungry. Anybody ever been so hungry you're about to pass out? Some of you are going, Gary, I'm inching up on it. And I'm going to look right back at you and tell you it's not 12 o'clock yet. Right? He's not really, I mean, if he's at the point of death, is a little bowl of stew going to help? No. But what does this do? It shows us that he is willing then to sell his birthright. It also shows us what kind of person Jacob is. Here's his brother dying of hunger. I'll give you a little bowl of my stew, but you got to give me your birthright. Fine. I can't eat my birthright. What's it good to me right now? So then Jacob goes one step farther. We're not just going to have just a little, we agreed about this in the woods. Swear to me now. Fine, I swear you can have it. And all of a sudden, just three verses earlier, five verses earlier, the older shall serve the younger. And we get to the end and we see that's exactly what's happening. And we see and we understand that Jacob is going to be the one that carries on the covenantal promises. And while I would love to talk about that, we're going to have to wait because it doesn't end well right here, does it? The guy that's going to carry on the covenantal promises is Jacob. Heel grabber, domesticated person who robs his brother of his birthright. Oh, okay, God, that's going well. Right? But it shows us that God is still, he's going to build a nation, and he's going to build a nation through Jacob. And even though this is a transitional chapter in the story, it's really unsettling. And we do learn that it's God's will, not the people, their intentions, or even their actions that ultimately counts. What counts is God's will and what he has said that he is going to do. And one of the things that God is going to do is he's going to turn his people into a great nation, and it's going to go from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. But here's the beautiful part. It doesn't end there because God is still turning his people into a great nation today. Real quickly, I want to conclude in 1 Peter 2:9. 1 Peter 2:9. As Peter is writing, he says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You see, God is still making nations now. He is still building his nation. And now what happens is everybody who comes to Christ, comes to God through Jesus Christ, we are placed within his nation. And you look around at your brothers and sisters and you understand this morning as we sit here and worship, we are worshiping as a holy nation. We are his people. And he is our God. And we enter into that nation, it says, when he calls us out of the darkness into his marvelous light. And we become his nation. We become the people, the recipients of the covenantal promise that he made to Abraham, that through him every nation would be blessed. We are a blessed nation through Abraham because the Messiah, the Savior, comes through Abraham's line. And what it reminds us of, what it just, and the truth that it just drives home, because we go back and we look and we saw that he chose Abraham and he chose Isaac and he chose Jacob. And we go through and we understand that the reason that God chose Jacob had nothing to do with Jacob. If you're that bad at 9 months, but it has all to do with God's grace. He calls us out of the darkness and turns us into a nation because of his great grace. Because he is a generous God who loves to dispense his grace. And because he is a generous God who gave Jesus Christ up to die on the cross for our sins. And because he does that, We can testify then, as Paul wrote in Ephesians 2:8, for by grace we have been saved through faith, and it's not of our doing, and it is a gift of God, not of our works, lest any one of us could boast. How did we end up being a great nation? How were we moved from this earthly nation to a holy nation of being God's people? God's grace. God's grace. Because we came to Christ through faith. But we're able to do that because we have a grace-giving, grace-loving God. And it's the grace that He still extends today and is still working and building His nation.
You've been listening to the Gary Talks About God podcast. Are you looking for a church? Well, Red Bank Missionary Baptist Church is a community of believers who exist to glorify God and see transformed lives through the gospel of Jesus Christ. You can find us on the web at www.redbankmbc.com. Also, come visit us on Sunday at 8104 Red Bank Road in Germantown, North Carolina. Did you like this podcast? We put one out each and every week, so don't forget to subscribe. We hope this has been a blessing to you, and we thank you for listening.